We are, I guess, coming close to the end of this class we've been going through on how to study and talking about a variety of different things along the way. Tom has done most of it. He is in preaching a meeting in Arkansas this week, so I'm stepping in for him to talk about the super exciting topic of word studies. So try to, restrain yourself as we get to, this kind of just... there is some interesting stuff about word studies. It's something that people want to do a whole lot, but it's one of those kinds of things that, on the one hand, anyone can do. I'm going to have something up here that I'm going to clarify later that, it sounds almost like, not anyone can do this, but in reality, anyone can do a good word study. You don't have to be some kind of linguistic scholar to do good word studies. We have great tools available to us to help us with that. On the other hand, there are dangers of doing word studies if you don't know the pitfalls. And so we'll spend a fair amount of time this morning talking about some of the mistakes that can be made very easily in doing word studies. And we'll see examples, some from the Bible, some just from language around us, of how these mistakes happen, and hopefully that'll give us some kind of backdrop for doing the right kind of word study when we get to talking about that. I'm not quite sure how far we'll make it this morning. We'll talk some more about this, I presume, on Wednesday night as well. So we'll work our way through this. It's kind of like over at the college, one of the required courses for biblical studies majors is to take first-year Greek. And my feeling, and this is someone who's had about a year and a half of Greek, I didn't take a whole lot of it myself, is when you get to end of your first year of Greek, you know just enough Greek to be dangerous, is the way that I tend to think about it. You haven't figured out all the ins and outs, but you kind of think you have. And so that's the same thing with word studies. It's easy to say, well, I know how to do a word study, and make all kinds of mistakes in the process of doing it. So you've got to know more than just the bare bones, and I want to point out some of the pitfalls to start with. So we'll start with some of the obstacles to doing word studies, some of the mistakes that people make. This is all going to be in terms of fallacies. So you'll see that word a lot. And if you've done any reading on this kind of thing, you've seen probably some of these. You may see them in different terms from one point to the next. But let me just go ahead and start running through some of these, starting with the root fallacy. The root fallacy says... it's the mistake that the real meaning of a word is found in its original root. So you figure out what the root of this word is, and once you know what the root of this word is, then you know what the word really means. And it's almost that there's this hidden meaning in the word that only if you know the root you can figure it out. And I'll talk about kind of the classic example from the Bible of that in just a second. But there's good reasons why this isn't always the case. And this isn't to say that the root of the word never has any bearing on the meaning, but that's not the end all. For example, the word butterfly. What does butterfly mean? Anybody? Butterfly? It's an insect. It's a little fluttery thing. Likes to flutter by, the butterfly. It's beautiful. Yeah, they're very colorful. We all know what we immediately have a picture of a butterfly in our mind when we say that. But what is the roots of the word butterfly? Well, it's a composition of two different words, the word butter and the word fly. Now, if you understand what those two words mean, then you have a better understanding of the word butterfly, correct? Because, no, what do you mean no? A butterfly is obviously a kind of fly that likes butter. Or perhaps if you take a pat of butter and make it a projectile, you have a butterfly. None of that has anything to do with what a butterfly is. The roots of this word are completely irrelevant to what the word means. And so, that's something of an absurd example. A pineapple, it's a kind of apple that only grows on a pine tree. No, it's a pineapple. The root has nothing to do with it. And so you have to bear that kind of thing in mind. What on earth is a sawhorse? What a sawhorse is. You don't have to think about what the roots are. The same thing is true in other words as well. The word nice. You know what the word nice means? It's a person who's kind, generous, perhaps, pleasant to be around. It's actually from a Latin word. Its root is from a Latin word that means ignorant. How many of you, when you are called nice, immediately take offense because that person called you ignorant? Well, nobody, because that's not what the word nice means. The root has nothing to do. It may have at one point meant something like that, but it doesn't anymore. Words change meaning. We'll talk about that as well. The word goodbye, it's a contracted form of the phrase, God be with you. That's, you know, the etymology, that's the root of the word goodbye. But how many people that say goodbye actually are consciously thinking, God be with you, when they say that? Or if you said, oh, why thank you, God be with you too, they wouldn't look at you like you're insane, because that's not what they mean. And so you have to understand there's more to it than just that. And it helps keep you, understanding that, it helps keep you from making mistakes in the Bible. A couple of examples. One, I've heard countless times the word faithful. What does the word faithful mean? What's that?
Full of faith.
Full of faith. I've heard that. Is that what faithful actually means in context?
Trusting.
Trusting, on the one hand, it sometimes means that you are trusting someone. It can also mean something else if you are a faithful person.
You're trustworthy.
Trustworthy. And there's no occasion in which the word faithful is used in the Bible that it really means full of faith. But you hear that. I've heard that countless times. The other example, and this is a little bit more precarious footing for me to go out on, because I don't know if anyone here has heard this or said it or believes it. So it's the word ecclesia, the word for church. It has been said that it's from two roots, ek, from, and kaleo, called out. And so it's this group of people who have been called out from something else based on those roots. Well, it's one of those words that at some point it may have meant that, but it's pretty clear by the time it's being used in the first century, it just means a group of people. And you see that in the Bible, you see it in other first century Greek literature. It's pretty clear that that word doesn't anymore carry this meaning of a special group of people who've been called out from someone else. Now, it is true that the church is a special group of people who've been called out from the world, but that's not what that word inherently means based on its roots in the first century. So those are a few examples of this mistake. So one thing you want to make sure when you're doing word studies is not to say, okay, here's what the word seems to mean based on context, but what are those roots? Then we'll find out what the word really means, because that's probably going to get you into more trouble. The basic rule, I thought about, you know, putting a rule for each one of these, but it's just going to get redundant. The basic rule is that context has priority over etymology. What the word means in its context is far more significant than what the roots mean. So context always takes priority. You're going to hear that a lot today. Second is the time frame fallacy. This is called something else in some writings, if you do any reading on this. But basically what this says is, or what it is when you kind of latch on to a late meaning of the word and read it back into an earlier time. Let me give you a few examples of this. It'll probably be easier to understand. Let's say you're reading an 1800s newspaper article, and you read about someone who is gay in the 1800s. What does that mean when you read it? Well, probably not what it means now. And the further you go back in time, it's going to be more certain that it means happy. But if you, as a 21st century reader, read that and say, aha, they're dealing with homosexuality back in the 1800s. See, it says gay right here. Well, no, that's a time frame fallacy. You're putting the wrong meaning on the word. You're picking up this later kind of meaning. An example of this that some denominational groups make is with the word bishop. The word bishop ultimately comes to mean, not in the Bible, but in the world, it comes to mean one person who has oversight over several different local congregations. That's what a bishop is in the religious world. Well, if you take that meaning of bishop and read it back into the Bible, then suddenly you have grand biblical proof for your concept of what, you know, of bishops. Well, that's not what that word means. There's no context in the Bible anywhere. There's nothing either in the history of the Bible or any of the writings that shows that kind of oversight of multiple groups of Christians in that way. Another example that I've seen a lot, Romans 1:16. You're familiar with, I presume. Romans 1:16, I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God to salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. You may have heard a preacher at some point refer to explosives when they're talking about this verse. The word power is the Greek word dunamis, which when you transliterate that into English, it's D-Y-N-A-M-I-S. We want to put a T-E at the end of that, right? And preachers will sometimes make this reference that it's, you know, this is the dynamite of God to salvation. That's how powerful the gospel is. Well, you know, it is powerful, but I highly doubt that Paul had that in mind when he used that word. And it's not particularly a good analogy when you stop and think it through. You know, dynamite is powerful, but it's also extremely destructive and deadly. Probably not the best kind of analogy to make in terms of talking about the power of the gospel. Paul will go on to talk about the power of the gospel, but he talks about it in terms of the resurrection, not in terms of explosives that kill people and you know, wreak havoc. So that, you know, that kind of thing. The word cheerful. God loves a cheerful giver. The Greek word there is hilaron, from which we get the word hilarious. So, you know, that's what the word means now. Does God love a hilarious giver? We should, you know, play a laugh track while we pass the plate around, because that's what God will know. You can't take this later meaning and put it back into the original kind of context, because context has priority. So who cares what it's come to mean at a later point? The original meaning is far more significant, and that's going to be determined by the context of the word and how it's used. The flip of this is the obsolescence fallacy, which is where you take a meaning that isn't used anymore and apply it forward rather than backward. So, you know, let's go back to our example of the word gay and how it's changed its meaning over time. You know, let's say you're reading a newspaper now and there's all of these discussions about rights and things like that, and you say, well, I don't understand. Why would anyone be opposed to happy people having equal rights? That just doesn't make any sense at all. Well, you're right, it doesn't make any sense at all, because that's not what that word means anymore. It does have that meaning in some context, but, you know, basically that meaning is obsolete in our culture, and it would have to be a very clear context to suggest that's what was being suggested. A word in the Bible that this is the case of is the word martyr. What do you think of when you think of someone who's a martyr? Someone who dies for their faith. Any other ideas on that? Something like that's probably what most of us will think of. Well, the word itself kind of went through a progression of really five different kinds of meanings. And you can see how one kind of naturally leads to the next. Initially, the word martis just meant someone who gave evidence. Sometimes it was in court, sometimes it was out of court, but it was just someone who was a witness is really all that it was. Then it kind of came to mean someone who gave some sort of solemn witness or affirmation, sometimes in the context of their faith. And then it came to mean someone who was a witness to their personal faith, even if they were threatened by death. And then it came to mean someone who was a witness of their personal faith by accepting that death. And then it came to mean someone who dies for a cause. And really, it's any cause anymore. If they die for it, they're a martyr. That's how the word has come to be used. And the question is, when you come across the word in a writing, at what point of this word's evolution is, you know, where is it being used? You don't want to take something from late times and say, you know, this word has very clearly at this point come to mean someone who has died for their faith, and you read it and you say, well, it just means someone who is a witness. Well, no, it doesn't mean that at that point, or vice versa. You can't go back and forth. And that also suggests or reminds us that changes in meaning aren't sudden. It doesn't, you know, one day you wake up and the word has changed meanings all of a sudden. It's something that happens. It is very much an evolution of the meaning. Slowly but surely, words change meaning. And so when you find one of these words and it's kind of somewhere in the middle, you know, what do you do with it then? And that's when, again, context has to be your guide. That's going to be the biggest clue of anything. Let me give you one example from the Bible that's much more clear than martyr, just because martyr is a little bit of a an interesting word of its own, and that's the Greek word solo, from which we get the word sing, when Paul says sing in Ephesians 5. Originally, that word meant to sing while plucking an instrument or something along those lines. And so there are some people who say, well, how can you people say you're not supposed to use instruments when this word's original meaning was to sing with an instrument? Well, the question isn't what was its original meaning. The question is, what did it mean when Paul used it? And it is pretty clear, and I could point you to some resources that talk about the history of the word meaning. It's pretty clear that by the time the first century came around, the word had lost the significance of singing with an instrument, and it just meant sing. And it could mean with an instrument, or it didn't have to, but usually it would be clarified at that point. It didn't mean inherently sing with an instrument anymore. All right, let me stop for a second. We've been through three of those super exciting word study fallacies. Any questions, comments, thoughts, other examples, ideas, accusations? Yeah, Shane.
and he had clarified me. His context was that, you know, he figured out after a while that he meant it was really good, but he kept talking about it was sick, and I'm like, what in the world is wrong with it that he sees so wrong with this? But that was how his age group had come to use that word. It was now something totally different than what
right. Right. And that's kind of an interesting sort of thing on its own, is that kind of fad usage of language. Because for the most part, something like that, it really wouldn't fit into something like obsolescence, because sick doesn't stop meaning sick. It just, in certain specific contexts, it means that. And then eventually that usage falls out by the wayside. Hopefully. But then, but still someone reading 50 years later would have to determine from the context what that word means. And usually it's going to be a definition. If it's in a dictionary or lexicon at all, it's going to be way down at the bottom of the list. A slang definition sometimes can mean something very good. And you'd have to figure out from the context that that's the definition that applied there. Well, that gives me a segue to a couple of other ones, and that is this multiple definitions of a single word and how that works out. And one is the overload fallacy, and that is to suggest that a word includes all of its meanings every time that it's used. You may have heard preachers like me say sometimes, maybe the author is being intentionally ambiguous to convey multiple ideas. Sometimes that's true. Sometimes what that means is I have no idea what's going on here, and I'll say this because it sounds nice. It's one of those things that very often a word doesn't use multiple meanings at once. Sometimes it does. But usually the author has one meaning in mind. It doesn't mean everything the word can mean. So, for example, what does the word spring mean? Somebody give me a definition of spring. It's a season. Okay. What else is spring? Coil of wire, piece of metal. What else is spring? What's that?
A verb.
You spring up. You jump. Okay, what else?
Water.
Source of water. What was that?
A season,
got that one already. Yeah, that's as far as I got with it. There may be more that I'm not picking up. But a season, the little metal coil, the act of jumping, a source of water. And so, if I said my favorite time of year is spring, well, maybe I'm being ambiguous and I mean all of those things. It's pretty clear what I mean. And, the solution is context. Whatever the answer is, if someone says spring into action, what does that mean? Well, whatever it is, the answer is not all of the above. It has a meaning in its context. And so you get out your lexicon, you have a word, you're trying to figure out what it means, and you see five different definitions. You can't say it means all of them. The other thing you can't say is that it means number one. That's something that I did as a child. I would do one of two things if I was, you know, looking up a word and I wanted to know what it meant. I would either say, well, the number one answer, the number one definition, that's it, because it's number one. Or if I didn't like number one, then I'd find one that I liked, and that was the one that it had to be. I presume I'm not the only person to do something like that at a younger age. Well, that's not the way words work. That's not how language works. It doesn't have the same meaning every time it's used. It doesn't have the most frequent meaning. There's a word we'll come back and talk about later, maybe today, maybe Wednesday night. It's a word that's used, I think, seven times by Paul. And six of those times, it very clearly has the same meaning. But the seventh time is a little bit iffy. It may mean something different, and I think that it does. And it's a legitimate meaning. But do you say, you know, six times out of seven it means this, therefore the seventh time it must mean this as well? Well, no, that's not how language works. The question is, what does it mean? And so the solution is, anybody want to take a guess? Context. What does it mean in its context? That's the clear answer to basically everything. Well, not quite. The word concept fallacy is another one. I've described this as the failure to understand synonyms. That's not a strict definition. Basically what this says, or what it is, it's the mindset that once you studied a word, you really understand the concept. So let's say we want to know what God has to say about the church. So we get out our concordances and lexicons and Bible, and we look up every instance of the word ecclesia, and we look at, you know, we read everyone, we study it, we figure out what everyone means in its context, and we have everything that God says about ecclesia, and just for safe measure, we find out where it was translated, the congregation of Israelites in the Old Testament was translated with that word when it was translated into Greek, and we look at all those two, and so we have a really big picture of ecclesia. Do we have now everything that God has said about the church because we've studied thoroughly the word ecclesia? No, why not? Okay. So off the top of your head, what are some other things that you might want to study if you want to study the idea of the church other than just the word ecclesia? What other kinds of phrases or ideas? Body assembly. That would... Some of the assemblies would be ecclesia, some might not. I'd have to look into that a little bit more. But yeah, that's definitely the idea. Charlie? Okay, so you've got Chloe's people. So just the idea of some people of that are directly connected to someone, brother. Congregation. Okay. The elect. Kingdom. Well, that'd be a really good one to look at. Someone said, you said body, right, Shane? Or was that Jeremy? Temple of the Holy Spirit. Household of faith. There are a variety of other kinds of terms that are directly related to this concept. And so you have to understand when you're doing word studies, you know, it's one thing to do a word study on that word and say you studied that word. That doesn't mean you studied everything related to that idea. And so, you know, if you want to really study the idea, then it has to go beyond just the word. Seventh is a selective evidence fallacy. I've pointed to this one already a little bit, and that's that we only cite the evidence that supports our preferred conclusion. We dismiss evidence that argues against our view. And so what does this word mean? Well, there are these five different pieces of evidence, and four of them sound good to me, and so those are the ones I'm going to consider and ignore the other one. Well, no, you have to consider all of the evidence, and that doesn't mean that you're wrong necessarily. It could be, you know, one of the later meanings of the word that would suggest, and that's where you get back to my example from earlier about picking the definition you like best not being a good idea. So you can't be selective, obviously, in the evidence, just because it matches your view. And finally, the English-only fallacy, and this is the one I alluded to earlier. This does not mean that you have to be a linguistic scholar to study words. That's not what I'm saying when I say the English-only fallacy. What I'm referring to is just the reality of translating. And the reality of translating is you don't have a clear picture of the original language, and we'll talk about how to get around some of this. As you know, I am, you're basically only an English reader to get past this. But basically what this amounts to is remembering that a single Hebrew or Greek word is often translated by a number of different English words. And so the Greek word paraklesis is translated comfort, encouragement, appeal, be encouraged, consolation, encourage, encouraged, encouraging message, exhortation, greatly encouraged, preaching, or urgently. That's a pretty wide range of English words, and a whole bunch of them translated from one Greek word. And comfort and exhortation and urgently don't really mean the same thing. And so we have to remember, you know, when you're doing a word study and you say, well, I want to know what this word urgently means, and you get out your concordance and you find that it's from the word paraklesis, you don't just look up all the places it's translated urgently. You really need to get back to that word and find out all the ways that it's translated and look at all of those examples as well if you're going to do a good word study of that. And so it can't just be from the English. You have to get back to the original language. And then the flip side of that is also true, and that is that a single English word can be used to translate a variety of Hebrew and Greek words. Classic example of this that you all know? Love. How many Greek words is translated love? Four in Greek, three in the Bible, primarily two in the Bible. Talking about their roots, not the verb versus noun form of that. The word comfort in English is translated from six different Greek words. And so when we're doing word studies, we need to make sure that we're getting to the underlying word that is being studied, not just the English translation in a single instance. So those are the kind of the pitfalls of word studies that I wanted to start with. We'll turn our focus next to how to properly go about doing a good, thorough word study, at least as far as I understand it, for what that's worth. Any questions or comments up to this point? Barry.
Well, you were talking about how to, you know, think about words and, you know, various meanings, that one word doesn't mean just one thing, mm-hmm. or, you know, various ways. It's almost like if you think about when you do a word search, like when you go to Google and you start putting in some keywords, you're thinking conceptually and you're thinking about what words relate to the concept that I'm trying to figure out. And then you get all of that information that comes up on Google, and you go through and you, by context, figure out which ones relate to what you're really trying to learn from. Mm-hmm. And if you think about that and you put it in the context of biblical study, it works the same way. Think about what you're trying to learn about, pick out your keywords, and start to build, you know, that whole library of context to figure out what that works. Sometimes we take what we do in our secular life, and we don't apply that, we get into biblical study, like, okay, I've got to throw all that out and think of a different way.
Right. And yeah, and it is always the context that is the determining factor. Another example that came to my mind when you were saying that is if you go to Wikipedia, because that's where all top scholars go for their information, and you plug in some common word, it's either going to take you to the main entry, the number one entry, and then it'll give you an option to click off of that for the full list of everything this word can mean, or it will just take you to that page straight away. What Wikipedia calls it is disambiguation. You've got an ambiguous word. It can mean a bunch of different things, and they will disambiguate it for you. I think they made that up, but I like it. And so on that page, you know, you have the word and some clarifying details. But in reality, you didn't have to look at that to figure out what the word meant. You knew exactly what you meant when you typed it in, but it's from the context of your mind, the way that it was being used, that it meant that. So it's that same thing, like you said, just, you know, from everyday life. We know how language works. At least most of us have a pretty good idea of how language works. We understand that a word doesn't mean the same thing all the time. It can have multiple definitions. You can't pick and choose. Context is the determining factor. And all of those things, we get that. But suddenly when we get to biblical studies, we kind of set that aside and try to play by a different set of rules. And that's still not how language works. Shane?
The whole idea of context throughout the study has been beneficial. I mean, it's funny, this past week, it really hit home. It was a prime example of lack of context. Somebody that had posted on Facebook, and this is sort of a motivational person, and they could use even a portion of the passage from Genesis chapter 11. They didn't even use the whole verse. So they extracted the last part of verse 6, and nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. This was supposed to be now, you know, motivational, and I'm thinking that this was right before God punished them because they reached this point. So, you know, people will extrapolate something that sounds really good and try to use it for some other purpose, because that's obviously not what that passage meant. It sounds good until you read how it was being used. And so that was just, it was really interesting. Wow, okay. The study, worked when you looked at it. It's like you're going back and look, and sure enough, it was in that context of the people being dispersed. So is that really a good thing?
Right. And I mean, that brings to my mind the kind of the classic example of Scripture being misused is the temptation of Jesus, where you've got Satan quoting Scripture to Jesus to try to convince him to sin. You take it out of its context and it doesn't mean the same thing anymore. So. All right, well, how to do word study. Well, you got two basic kinds of doing ways why, or you got two basic reasons why you would do a word study, I think is what I was trying to say. Starting with, I want to do a word study, in which case you choose whatever word you want to study, and usually it's something that comes up because, you were having a discussion in Bible class, you heard the preacher talking about something, this Bible class teacher said faithful doesn't mean full of faith, so I'm going to go look this up, and you want to go look up all the, so that's one way, and you just kind of choose a word and do it. The other reason why you would do a word study is if you're doing it as part of a textual study. So let's say you're studying Romans 1 because that's what my Bible is still open to, and you're in Romans 1:16, and you're like, hey, power of God to salvation, what does that word power mean? And so I'm going to do a word study on that particular word, and so it's part of a larger textual study is the reason why sometimes you do it. If that is why you're doing a word study, let me suggest three basic things that I think that are helpful. And first of all, it's not just to study whatever word you strikes you as interesting. What the words you want to do word studies on when you're doing a textual study is words that are crucial to the passage in some way. And that kind of takes us back to the earlier stage of this class where how do you know which words are important? Well, words that are repeated, words that are part of contrast, words that are part of list, words that are comparisons, words that are figures of speech, all of those kinds of things that we talked about earlier, those are going to be the significant words to the passage. And so the one that I put up here as an example is repeated words. If Paul is using the same word five times in two verses, that's probably an important word that you want to do a thorough study on. And this is a place where you will want to be reading from a formal equivalent, or sometimes it's called essentially literal translation of the Bible, that is in particular not the King James Version. And I'm not just bashing the King James Version, I'll tell you why I say that in a second. First of all, you want a formal equivalent or essentially literal translation because they want to, for the most part, use the same English word to translate the same Greek word when it's used in the same context. So if Paul uses the same Greek word five times, they're going to use the same English word five times. The reason I say not the King James Version is because when the King James was translated, they were especially interested in the beauty of the literature. They had seen what happened with the German Bible. When Luther translated the Bible into German, it kind of became the dictionary of the German language, and words that weren't in the German Bible fell into disuse. And so they wanted to preserve the literary beauty of the English language. So what the King James Version will do, if Paul uses the same word five times, they'll translate it at least two different ways, if not three or four different ways, in that same context. So, it sounds a whole lot better, but in terms of word studies, King James, you want to set that aside and get the New American Standard, the English Standard, something more modern that really shows the repetition of the language. You can read your King James all you want, but it's not best for word studies.
I did a study here and presented it, cara and caris, in Philippians particularly.
Yeah, and you kind of get an idea of what's going on with all of that. Other thing you want to look for is words that are unclear, puzzling, difficult. You come across a word and you say, well, I'm not sure what that means. I don't know what this means in this context. How on earth does that relate to what Paul's saying at all? Those are the kinds of words you want to do word studies on if you're studying from a passage. So when you actually get around to doing the study itself, it really boils down to two basic things. First of all, you have to determine what a word could mean. What is the semantic range, as it is called, of this word? Word can mean, we talked about spring already, right? We had four different things. One that has probably a wider range is the word hand. What is the word hand? Well, you know, it's this thing at the end of my arm. It has the idea of, you know, possession. You know, it's in my enemy's hands. It's a side of an argument. On the one hand, on the other hand, it's a pledge. I give you my hand in marriage. It's a style of penmanship. I've written this in my own hand. It's a skill. He tried his hand at sailing. You know, and on we could go. There's probably four or five other things we could come up with along the way. So you first have to determine the range of meaning. Because if you're going to figure out what it actually means, you really need to have a good basis of what it could mean. And this is where your concordance is going to come in very, very handy. And so what you'll want to do is you'll want to get a hold of a concordance and find that word in the concordance where it shows up. Here is a marvelous picture of Young's analytical concordance on the word preserved. And what you'll see is this word preserved is translated from five different original language words. Let's see, we've got four Greek and one Hebrew. And so the question is, let's say I'm studying Hosea 12 and I come across the word preserved. What I want to do is I want to find Hosea 12. Aha, here it is. So this is the word we're looking for. It's the word shamar. And so we know what word we want to study now. We don't want to study all the rest of these passages because it's not the same word. Did I say four Greek and one Hebrew? Boy, I can't count. Three Hebrew and two Greek. Wow. So, shamar is our word we want to look for. And so we say, okay, this is the word we want to study. We want to study these two passages. But maybe shamar isn't just translated preserved. Maybe shamar is translated another way. And depending on the concordance you're using, it's going to have a different place you need to look to find the word shamar and all the ways that it's translated. In Young's, it's at the back. And so you look at shamar and you find it's also translated beware or keep or look narrowly or mark or observe or preserve or regard or reserve or save or spy or take heed or wait for or watch. And then in the participle form, if you want to get into other forms of the verb or other forms of the word, it goes beyond that and actually goes to the top of the next page as well, but I didn't feel like getting all of those. Let's say, you know, we don't care about the participles or the passives or the infinitives. We just want to look at the word itself, so we'll just stick with this top section. So now we have a pretty good idea of the semantic range just based on translation. And that's a pretty wide range. Again, I mean, you know, preserve doesn't mean the same thing as spy, for example. It can mean something similar to save or keep even. And obviously, when you look at this, you say, well, how is it used most frequently? The number to the right is how many times it's translated that way. So keep is the most frequent translation. Observe is next. Preserve is third. In that. So, you know, you're looking at this, and so what the next step that you would want to do is actually go look up these verses. Now, if you're doing this one, you might want to take sample verses of something like keep, rather than looking up 284 different verses. But if you read as many of these verses as you can and see how the word is used in its context, then you'll have a pretty good idea of how it's used. And what you'll find is there are times where you may or may not agree with the translation in that context. And you say, well, let me think about this one a little bit more. Because as you begin to understand this semantic range of the word, you start to understand the different ways that it could be used. Translation is one of those things that, you know, it's not an exact science. And, you know, you don't want to just disagree with a room full of scholars for kicks. But there are times where they get it wrong. Probably not nearly as often as I would, but still, you know, it's something that happens. And so you say, well, wait a second, this word, you know, it could mean preserve, but I think really in this context, it really has more of the idea of an active kind of saving rather than just a more, you know, passive preserving, and perhaps that's the way it should be translated. And what you'll find in its uses is that it really can be broken down. I mean, if you did nothing but look up all of the verses that are connected to these words, without the list, you just find all the shamars and you don't care how it's been translated and you read all of those verses. One thing you could do that's a very beneficial exercise in word study is to read them all yourself and say, what does the word mean in this verse? And kind of write it off to the side. Well, what does the word mean in this verse? And write it off to the side. And what you'll find is you end up with a list that's going to look something like this. you begin to see how it's used, and you can kind of group them on your own. And that's, you know, just a really helpful, thorough way of doing a word study in that regard. And so then, one second, Brother Wint, and then the next step, and we'll talk more about this on Wednesday, is to determine what the word in context does mean. So once you have a good idea of what it could mean, then you need to narrow things down and figure out what it actually means in that context. Because just knowing all of the options is helpful in understanding the word, but in terms of, you know, your textual study, what does it mean here in this verse that I'm studying? That's what you're looking for. If you're just doing a word study, you know, what does the word faithful mean? You study all the examples, you figure out all the different contexts, and then you have a good idea of what the word means. But for a passage study, you want to understand ultimately what it means there in what you're studying. Brother Wynn.
One of the first places I go to is vines.
Yeah, we'll talk some about tools next time. Vines is a helpful English-based dictionary.
Not only Greek, but now right. They have Hebrew.
Right. And then the problem ultimately with doing word studies as an English speaker is when you get to the lexical tools, those are going to be based primarily in the original languages. So you can do your word study with your concordance and looking up verses and determining things, but you'll probably need a little bit of help when you want to pick up, you know, what is the authoritative lexicon, at least as far as lexicons can be authoritative.
Thayer was it then,
yeah.
You had to look at the Greek first.
Right, and that's the same thing with, you know, Bauer now, which is kind of the standard. It's rooted in the Greek, or Brown Driver Briggs in the Hebrew. It's based on the original language. We'll talk some about those resources and other things next time, though. All right, well, thank you for your attention.